We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Gerald Horn. He is the Moores Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston and author of, I believe, nearly 30 books. But the latest is The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and Caribbean. Welcome to the program, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start here with the way that you start your book. And I should say that some of your books, your most recent ones, are sort of working your way backwards through history. And this one starts at about 1600, obviously in the 17th century, and moves forward. And a big part of what takes place and where the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism in this century come from are a function of what happens to Great Britain during this time.
Well, you are correct, particularly concerning working my way back through history. Right now, I'm at work on a book on the 1500s, the 16th century. And as I dig deeper into the past, I come to realize that the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism are quite elusive. But in any case, with regard to the book at hand, I start the book by saying that in the early 1600s, England was a minor power on the fringes of Europe. By the end of the 1600s, England, soon to become Great Britain, was well on its way to becoming the planet's reigning superpower, and then passed on the baton, in a sense, to its spawn, now known as the United States of America, which has carried that hegemony into the 21st century, although, as you know, there is some question as to whether or not it will survive the 21st century. In any case, the answer that I put forward in terms of how this transformation took place in the 1600s can be reduced to one word, and that is slavery. That is to say that to telescope a complicated set of facts rather tightly, what happens in 1655 is that England seizes Jamaica from Spain. And this is, first of all, a knockout blow to Spain, which had a first mover's advantage, because recall that in 1492, Madrid had sponsored Christopher Columbus's trip to what we now call the Americas. And as a direct result, you have tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people still speaking Spanish in the Americas to this very day. But what happens in 1655 with Spain ousted from Jamaica is that this blow is delivered to the pretensions of Spain, and at the same time it boosts England, because what happens is that England then moves rather aggressively to develop sugar plantations on the island of Jamaica. This leads to the so-called sugar boom, and sugar becomes wildly popular. It is not only used to sweeten tea and coffee, but it's seen by some as a miracle drug, seen by others as a marker of sophistication. And this sends currency and money flowing into the coffers of London, which then is used to build more ships, which are then used, for example, to oust the Dutch, another rising power, delivered a knockout blow by England. The Dutch are ousted from what is now New York City and what are now a number of the mid-Atlantic states of the United States in 1664, sending it tumbling down the ladder of leadership globally. And this leads to even more wealth pouring into the coffers of England. And some of this wealth is used to ensnare and enchain more Africans to grow more sugar. And by 1672, the Royal African Company is organized. And the Royal African Company is, of course, under the thumb of the monarch, and it's used to ensnare and enchain more Africans, developing more wealth for England. And then in 1683, you have another knockout blow delivered against a competitor and a challenger to England. I'm speaking of the fact that in 1683, the Ottoman Turks are stopped at the gates of Vienna, And I'm coming to discover, with regard to my project I'm working on now, that the Ottoman Turks are a major force from the, say, 1300s up until about 1683, but they go tumbling down the ladder of leadership globally, which gives a further boost to England. And then in 1688, the rising merchants in England then deliver a kind of knockout blow to the monarch. That is to say, they clip the wings of the monarch by dint of what we call the Glorious Revolution, which turns the monarch into what Queen Elizabeth is today in London, a kind of figurehead, and empowering the rising merchants, who then move to deregulate the African slave trade, that is to say, allowing more merchants to enter this noxious business. And they descend upon Africa with the maniacal energy of crazed bees, manacling and handcuffing every African in sight, delivering them not only to the Caribbean but the North American mainland. And thereby, you see how England becomes a major power by the end of the 1600s.
So, okay, so that is that's a lot of history very quickly. Let's go back a little bit and look at the way that this period, and I guess maybe the subsequent period of the founding of the United States, but also the period that leads up to it, on some level, there are multiple perspectives of this, right? I mean, we can look at what we call now the United States of America as sort of a refuge for certain so-called white people coming from Europe. We can see it as from the other perspective of Britain using these people to expand their power, and then of course, from the perspective of the indigenous people, and those people ultimately came to be almost the fuel via their actual bodies of this expansion. And that is the part of the apocalypse. I mean, I feel like living in the United States, having grown up here, that I got a good sense of it as a good sense of the pioneer myth. Let's talk about how much we hear about the other part of that, the apocalypse part.
Well, the apocalypse, in many ways, is what happens to the indigenous population, who are not only liquidated and wiped out and ousted from their land, but many of them are then sold into slavery in the Caribbean, sold into the slave markets of the Ottoman Turks. In fact, you can probably find Native American DNA scattered throughout this small planet. And then there's the apocalypse that befalls Africa and the African populations, the millions who die on the so-called Middle Passage, that is to say, oftentimes tossed into the waters to be fed upon by sharks as the boats are crossing the Atlantic, in a period stretching from about 1500 to the late 1880s, when Brazil abolishes slavery. And then, of course, there's the point that you also mentioned, which is a part of my book, which is the construction of whiteness. That is to say that England's population today is only about 65 million, and yet it was seeking to preside over this sprawling empire that came to include India, a contemporary population of 1.3 billion, not to mention North America, including what is now the United States and Canada, Caribbean islands. It came to include a good deal of Africa. And whiteness, as I tell the story, is a sort of constructive intervention. It's an intervention that is constructed, to deal with the fact that England, London, required a goodly number of soldiers and settlers that the England itself could not provide. Not only that, but the construction of whiteness also helped to resolve certain tensions in England. In my 1500s book, I'm dealing with all of this conflict between not only the English and the Irish, which continues to this very day, but the English and the Scots. I mean, the Scots, at least the leadership, So in some ways, they consider themselves closer to France, England's long-term and long-time antagonist, than they did to London. But by crossing the Atlantic, you saw a kind of reconciliation between and amongst these settlers of English and Irish and Scottish background under the new identity politics that we call whiteness, which was involved in subjugating and subduing a continent and generating tremendous wealth, as I said a few moments ago. And then ultimately, that platform and rubric of whiteness was extended, I would say, to the entire European continent. And in fact, not only the European continent, from the Atlantic to the Urals, whereby those who have been warring on the shores of Europe, British versus German, German versus Russian, German versus Pole, Russian versus Pole, Serb versus Croat, Greek versus Macedonian, Northern Italian versus Southern Italian. Magically, when they cross the Atlantic, somehow they become, quote, white, unquote. And it also reconciles religious tensions and contradictions, too. In my 1500s book, I'm dealing quite a bit with the Protestant versus Catholic conflict, which I deal with also in the 1600s book. But there's a kind of reconciliation between and amongst not only Protestants and Catholics, but also between Christians and the Jewish population to a certain degree, too, because the Jewish population ultimately are incorporated into this broader category of whiteness as well. And in fact, if you look closely, you'll see that, as I say in a footnote, it's sort of a misnomer, which I confess, to equate whiteness with Europeans, since you have folks who are defined as white in the United States, such as Ralph Nader, who are of Lebanese descent. And, of course, there are those, some sociologists have argued, that are of Iranian descent that are constructed as white in the United States. So this is a very flexible, elastic concept. It was quite essential to the construction of the United States of America, and it was quite essential to the rise of England in the 1600s.
So I have a couple of questions regarding that. One is, how elastic has that been through the history of the United States? Because I mean, what you're describing is this sort of imperial overreach by London. Therefore, we need more people like us in some ways to subjugate the people, the other. And, you know, we have some bonds that we can overcome, and we're just going to call them, you know, we have bonds that are distinct, at least in terms of our way of life, that we're just going to refer to as white. But it seems like, you know, then the later you get into American history, when indigenous people are not as much of an issue to the expansion of the American project, some of that comes creeping back in, right? Like when Italian immigrants or Irish immigrants come to the States in maybe the late 1800s or the 1900s. Early 1900s, they're otherized maybe more than they would have 200 years earlier.
No, definitely. Absolutely. I mean, the construction of whiteness is a process. It can be seen more as a film loop than a photograph. It works itself out over decades, if not centuries. I mean, there were torchings of Catholic convents in the U.S. Northeast as late as the 1820s and the 1830s. We're all familiar with the sordid history of anti-Semitism in the United States, including, say, the lynching of Leo Frank, the Jewish businessman in Georgia in the World War I era, approximately a century ago. We're all familiar with the stories about Irish need not apply, for example, that often greeted some immigrants, and, of course, some of your listeners might have seen the movie Gangs of New York, the Martin Scorsese film, which deals with the difficult integration of Irish immigrants into the fabric of New York City in the antebellum era and in the U.S. Civil War era. But once again, this is a process. And today, as we all know, in the United States of America, in the U.S. ruling elite, you have represented the various European ethnic groups whose ancestors once faced discrimination, including Jewish Americans and the U.S. Senate, U.S. corporate chiefs of Irish descent, U.S. corporate chiefs of Scottish descent, U.S. corporate chiefs of Italian descent. So once again, this is a process.
Can it go both ways? I mean, through time. I mean, I guess that's what I was asking. Is that, you know, was there a time when we're talking about in the 1600s where the need for more people like the British versus the indigenous populations or those people that they have basically kidnapped into slavery, did that sort of drop some of the maybe the prejudice they had against Irishmen or Scottish, those then got built up as they didn't need them in the same way they did earlier? Like, I get the idea that things evolve through time where people are more generally accepted, but can it also flow the other way depending on the need for those people?
Well, and that raises an intriguing question, a provocative question, which causes me to dust off my, put on my oracle cap, insert my cap as a seer, and to figure out, could it go backwards in the 21st century? That is to say, can the integration of all these different European ethnic groups into a larger fabric of whiteness, can that be reversed? And I would say yes. Now, I'm speculating, of course, but I would say yes, definitely, that if it can go forward, to me, it can go backwards. And I think it depends upon certain objective conditions. And to put my big toe in the water of the present, I would say that given the rise of right-wing populism in the North Atlantic community, not only in the United States, but now in Italy, with Brexit and perhaps Quitaly, that is to say Italy quitting the European Union next, there are some signs that I think people would be silly not to pay attention to that suggest that, yes, we can go backwards.
I want to go back to the 1600s, and maybe the answer is you won't have the answer for us until you finish the book on the 1500s. But that relationship between white supremacy and slavery, and maybe you have to go back even earlier in terms of capitalism. But there, lay out for us the sort of the chicken egg scenario. I mean, what was slavery a function of white supremacy, or was white supremacy constructed to make slavery that much easier so that we could look upon as Africans as we would, you know, the iron ore we might take from the ground?
Well, that's the $64 question, and it's kept generations of historians busy for decades. I would like to believe that white supremacy was a function of slavery, as you articulated in your latter comment, that thereby it was a kind of pragmatic intervention. And I hinted that in the early pages of the book we're discussing when I talk about how in Massachusetts, slave dealers oftentimes were reprimanded for bringing enslaved Africans into what is now New England. But that changed over time, as I try to point out. I also, since we broached the question of my 1500s book, I'm also coming around to the idea, and I think, well, I'll let this out anyway, even though I haven't written it, and I think it's a contribution that, you know, actually if somebody else takes the idea, that's fine with me, is that in order to understand slavery and the rise of white supremacy, it might be useful to understand the Crusades. Because the Crusades, which lasted for hundreds of years, recall that Islam was founded approximately 1,300 years ago and leads to this endless, incessant cycle of conflict between Muslims and Christians. The Crusades were largely pan-European projects. That is to say, you had often Swiss and Germans and French and what we now call Italians and Spanish uniting against particularly the Ottoman Turks, who were Muslims. And then secondly, to use your phrase, it requires a kind of othering, if you like, of Muslims, seen as this alien population. and seen as a civilizational threat. And, of course, there's enslavement on both sides. I mean, the Ottoman Turks are enslaving the Christians are enslaving the Muslims. And in some ways, I think what happens after the so-called European Age of Discovery, post-1492, is that as the Portuguese in particular, who are also part of the Crusades, begin to sail southwards and then begin to enslave Africans, some of whom, of course, are Muslims, and many of whom, even if they're not Muslims, they're sort of cast as Muslims as being part of the other. And so I think that in order to understand slavery and white supremacy, it might be useful to understand the Crusades, although, once again, I think that I tend to believe right now that white supremacy arises out of slavery, but I'm trying to keep an open mind because the deeper I go back into history, the more revelations and enlightening factors I tend to encounter.
And to what extent is, I mean, the compulsion to enslave people a function of capitalism, or capitalism is a cousin to just that compulsion on some level?
Well, first of all, as I'm sure you know, slavery is a socioeconomic system, like feudalism is a socioeconomic system, and capitalism, a socioeconomic system. It often arose from what to do with prisoners of war. I guess you could kill them or you could enslave them. I think what happens with the Americas and the rise of England in the 1600s in particular, you have two relatively new developments. That is to say that oftentimes people were enslaved because they were thought not to believe in the correct God, for example. And then you have, with the so-called Enlightenment, you have these doctrines of science that tend to suggest that certain people are superior, certain people are inferior, and therefore they deserve their fate and destiny, which is slavery. Read, of course, whites versus blacks, or whites versus Native Americans, for example. And then that's yoked to this dynamic engine known as capitalism. And that's also a relatively new development. That is to say, the use of free labor, and then that becomes a very stubborn beast to tame. That's why the U.S. Civil War was one of the bloodiest conflicts, certainly in North America, if not in human history, with 700,000 people slaughtered over 4 years, because people did not want to give up their property. Oftentimes when I tell this to my students, you know, being students, they're fiddling with their smartphones as I'm lecturing.
Right.
And I'll go up and snatch their smartphone from their hands and say, I've just confiscated your property, just like property was confiscated from the slave owners in 1865. And just like you're not happy now, they were not happy then. And they were even more unhappy because their property then was walking around claiming to be free and equal, which was contrary to what the slave owners thought. Not only that, but their confiscated property, they were not compensated. Unlike, for example, the slave owners in the Caribbean in the 1830s when London abolished slavery, they compensated the slave owners. The slave owners in Dixie were not compensated, which creates even more fury, which helps to give rise to the Ku Klux Klan and this endless cycle of violence and tensions and resentment that we've yet to extirpate in the United States to this very day.
I know that's not, it may not necessarily be, you know, the job of a historian, but do you think that that was a mistake? I mean, do you think that the we would see a different level of resentment if, and for the sake of argument too, let's just say the slave owners and the slaves were compensated at that juncture. Do you think it would have made a meaningful difference in terms of the trajectory of white supremacy and race relations more broadly in this country?
Well, let me dust off my crystal ball once again. And as I peer into my crystal ball, what I seem to see...
I'm glad you have that thing so close. I appreciate that.
The answer is YES. That I think it could have made and would have made a difference. But then again, I'm only speculating.
Right.
And I'm trained as a historian, not as a fortune teller, unfortunately.
Well, so if, you know, and we would look at this, the history of the United States and how much of our success as a country, I guess, to shorthand it, has been a function of both the genocide that was involved in terms of the indigenous people and the slave labor and even I would say the subjugation following emancipation of a significant percentage of our population. Has that ended? I mean, as an economic engine, can you give it, as a historian, can you say as a major factor? I mean, because like clearly in the settlement of this country, slave labor is a huge asset, right? And then in terms of the economy of this country in the first half of the 19th century, it is a huge asset. And I would imagine, too, that having a population that is then exploited, where you're making $1.15 off of every, you know, what should be a dollar, is also a huge asset in terms of building American wealth, or particularly white American wealth. Was there a point where that stopped? Has it stopped?
Has it stopped? Well, the United States still is heavily dependent on cheap labor. I mean, as a person who lives part of the year in Texas, part of the so-called Texas boom is heavily dependent upon millions of cheap laborers, particularly from south of the border. And if you're able to pay people less, not to mention pay people nothing, well, then you can generate quite a bit of wealth. And then keep in mind that the African slave trade at its apex was one of the most profitable enterprises known to humankind. You could invest $1 and get $1,700 back. And there are those today who would kill their firstborn for a 1,700% profit, let alone some African who they did not know. And then we also know that on the cusp of the U.S. Civil War, circa 1860, the most profitable investment in the United States was, of course, the investment in the bodies of enslaved Africans. 4 million strong, billions of dollars in wealth. And then, of course, you know, that wealth was liquidated 5 years later, causing quite a bit of fury and angst. And that fury and angst is yet to dissipate to this very day.
Well, but I mean, I'm saying, during Reconstruction, I imagine you have a lot of former slaves who then begin to work the land for sub-minimum wages. Can we track that level of exploitation, at least in terms of the African-American community? And is there an era where that ended, where there was some type of parity, at least, or are we still sort of drawing on that exploitation, I guess is what I'm asking. I mean, you've answered it to a certain extent with immigrant labor, but in terms of people who are, you know, who have citizenship, are we still functioning that way? Or and if not, is that can we see the implications of that, I guess? Am I clear on the question?
I think I understand. I mean, are we still functioning that way? To a degree, yes. I mean, obviously, fortunately, slavery has been abolished. But as you know, there's a gender gap in terms of what men tend to earn and what women tend to earn. And that causes and compels many women to work for less. And then that means more profit for some. And then there's a kind of racial wealth gap, which sociologists have been writing about for years, which oftentimes causes Black Americans to be forced to work for less as well. And then someone is profiting at the other end from that kind of exploitation. So the answer, short answer to your question, is parity, to use your term, no, in terms of racial equality, in terms of wealth, but has that egregious exploitation of slavery, has it dissipated? Oh, absolutely, and fortunately.
Yeah, I guess I was just trying to get at that that last part that you touched upon, wealth. I mean, we know that in addition to there being a huge income disparity, there's a tremendous wealth disparity between the white and black community. And a lot of that has to do with housing, which, of course, there's been plenty of government policies that have prevented African-Americans from building that type of intergenerational wealth through their homes. And then that is exploited because, you have a higher incidence of people having less intergenerational wealth and need to puts them in, I guess, a weaker bargaining position when it comes to work. And speaking of work, I know that you have written about this, at least within the past couple of years. And the kneeling during the Star Spangled Banner has come back into play over the past, week or two, as the NFL has determined that they're going to allow players to have the option to stay in the locker room versus come out for the national anthem, which in and of itself was a recent artifice just to promote the defense, the U.S. military. But give me your perspective on what's happening there. And we're already starting to see some, analogies between Colin Kaepernick and, God help us, Roseanne Barr.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. But I mean, give me your perspective on this. I mean, is there anything encouraging about the fact that we are now seeing this type of protest so being bold enough to implicate U.S. pastimes?
Well, I find it very encouraging, although I don't find it encouraging the fact that billionaire football owners basically bent the knee to the alleged billionaire in the Oval Office. That was very discouraging. Second of all, as I'm sure you know, the protest led by Colin Kaepernick, the former San Francisco 49ers quarterback, follows in the wake of a long legacy and history of black athlete protests, going back even to Jack Johnson,
right,
who Mr. Trump just pardoned, who, as you know, was convicted about a century ago, fundamentally for dating and marrying Euro-American women, and then had to go into exile. And was a very political figure. I mean, when he went in exile, as I talk about in my book Black and Brown, he was basically in solidarity with the Mexican Revolution, was trying to lobby the Mexican government to intervene on the side of black Americans who were then being lynched in Texas and throughout Dixie. And so there's that long legacy that Colin Kaepernick exemplifies. But at the same time, these athletes are going to pay a price. Kaepernick may win his lawsuit, which may make him a wealthier man, but then he may not win his lawsuit against the NFL owners for not hiring him. And then there's the regional disparity that's introduced. That is to say, the New York Jets have indicated that they're not going to be hawkish with regard to punishing their players who protest. You can expect the same for the Seattle Seahawks and perhaps even the San Francisco 49ers, irony there. But the Houston Texans, for example, has their owner, Mr. McNair, has already indicated that he's going to take a hard line against any protesting athletes. So this is going to increase and enhance and exacerbate the regional disparities in the United States of America, which is already a part of the U.S. political polarization, with those, particularly in the South and the Midwest, lambasting what they call coastal elites in places like Seattle, San Francisco, and New York.
I mean, do we have historical precedent for? I mean, there's a feeling that we're in a cycle of a blowback in terms of racial animus. All right. Do we have precedents for this? I mean, we spoke to her name escapes me now, but who had written about white rage and about a pattern of maybe two steps forward, one steps back, and blowback every time we have any type of significant gain for African Americans in terms of either their cultural or legal to the benefits or rights. And that in the wake of Barack Obama, it was Carol Anderson, and in the wake of Barack Obama, that we're seeing sort of this blowback. I mean, is this are we in the midst of that type of cycle, or do we need more time as a historian to make that assessment?
Well, I would say actually yes to both questions. I think we are in the midst of that kind of cycle, but we can't be sure unless more time passes. That is to say, it's unclear in 2018 if Donald Trump is a sign of what is to come in the 21st century, or if it's just a passing squall. I tend to think that as of now, it seems like the former, that he is a sign of things to come. And I would hope, and what I would like to think, that I'm wrong, but there are too many signs pointing in an opposing direction to indicate that I may be sadly correct.
Well, I know, again, this is, I'm asking you to put on a completely different hat, but can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, where does this trajectory lead if it turns out not to be a passing squall, as you call it?
Well, first of all, within the Trump base, there seems to be a high level of tolerance for Mr. Trump's antics, including consorting with white supremacy, rationalizing the Charlottesville distasteful episode that took place there with the killing of Heather Heyer, the baiting of black athletes, and all of the rest. And now, supposedly, you're not supposed to indict the Trump base. You're supposed to see them as well-meaning people who somehow have voted 63 million strong for a person who consorts with white supremacists. And to me, that becomes then part of the problem, because it assumes that this one individual is the problem, and there's not a deeper problem. And if you assume there's not a deeper problem, then you're not going to necessarily assault that deeper problem. Right. If you don't assault that deeper problem, it'll probably fester and proliferate. And that's where I see the United States going off the rails in the 21st century.
It's failing to address that deeper problem.
Absolutely. And to act like it's just one individual, which I guess is comforting, because that can allow you to get some sleep at
right.
night. And you can say, oh, okay, once he's impeached or indicted by Bob Mueller, then this nightmare will go away. But I don't know. I think that's a kind of fantasy, quite frankly.
What characterize that deeper problem for me? I mean, how would you assess it in its essence, as opposed to maybe how it manifests itself?
Well, in some of my 20th century writings and some of my recent lectures that I've given in 2018, one of the points that I've stressed is that liberals and progressives like to think that this progress that has been made on the anti-racism front has been universally accepted or generally accepted, so let us say, by the Euro-American majority. And I'm not sure if that's accurate. I mean, if you look at the revolt that took place in Little Rock in 1957 after the desegregation of the high schools, which required Mr. Eisenhower to send federal troops into the cafeteria to keep black students from being mauled, if you look at what happened at the desegregation of the University of Mississippi in the early 1960s, once again, federal troops had to be inserted there, leading to deaths. If you look at what happened in Boston to show it wasn't just a sectional crisis, that is to say the desegregation crisis in the 1970s, where you had black kids once again coming under threat because they were trying to go to schools where apparently they were not wanted. And once again, to show that it was not a sectional issue, if you look at the Yonkers desegregation crisis of the 1980s, which, by the way, was depicted quite admirably in a movie you can find on Netflix. Show me a hero.
Right.
Very interesting. Did you see that?
I saw part of it. It's still on my list of things to watch. I have.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yes.
I mean, they did an admirable job. And so what I'm trying to suggest is that there's been this tremendous backlash against the idea of equality. And then if you look at Dixie, where in 1991, David Duke, a Nazi and Klansman, got 55% of the Euro-American vote in a race for governor and only got turned away from office because of a massive turnout by the black vote, which voted against him 9.5 to 0.5. Or if you look at Dixie, Mississippi, Alabama, where there's this amazing cross-class coalition where white poor and white rich vote 9-1 for the same candidate, oftentimes the Republican, every time the Republican, including Donald J. Trump. So oftentimes I think our progressive and liberal friends, they would prefer to think, and I understand, because if you think that we're making progress and that those who are staying in the way of progress are just a rather obstreperous minority, well, then you can sleep better at night. But some of us might have to pay a price for other people's illusions.
And how much is that a function of our capitalism? Again, I guess this goes back to that very first question. How much of that a function of capitalism or economic insecurity, and how much of it is the sort of, I guess, almost the habit of white supremacy?
I think they're kind of intertwined. The example I oftentimes use in lectures is Pete Gray. I don't know if you're a baseball fan, but Pete Gray was a one-armed outfielder with the old St. Louis Browns. And this was at a time of Jim Crow when two-armed outfielders like Willie Mays and Frank Robinson and Hank Aaron, black Americans, were not allowed to play Major League Baseball. So because of Jim Crow, you could have a one-armed white outfielder get a job and a superior black athlete not get a job. And so a kind of racial resentment helps to undergird a kind of economic advantage. And if you blow up that microcosm to a macrocosm, you begin to see that there is a kind of intertwining of racial resentment and economic anxiety.
They feed on each other, or they how does that relationship work? I mean, in that example, I can see the one-armed baseball player is feeling a little better about it because he's got a job opportunity he might not otherwise have had. How does that interrelate, though?
Well, then once desegregation comes, he doesn't have a job.
Right.
And then that leads to a certain resentment and a certain anxiety because you can no longer pay the bills the way you once did. And I think oftentimes in the United States, it becomes easier. It reminds me of the ad. I'm speaking to you from North Carolina, which is the home of Jesse Helms, the former Republican senator from this state. Mm-hmm. And you may recall the ads he used very successfully and effectively, television ads in the 1990s. Where there's a white hand getting a letter, and he balls up the letter and throws him to the wastebasket, and the voiceover says, "You could have gotten that job, but for affirmative action," you see. And so, in other words, you can explain and explicate any sort of failure that you're subjected to by blaming the racial other. Now, of course, what Mr. Trump has done is take it to another level by scapegoating immigrants.
Right.
But it has a similar taproot.
Interesting. Well, Gerald Horn, Moore's Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, author of his most recent Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in the 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. Have you named your 16th century book yet?
The Dawning of the Apocalypse.
Well, fantastic. I can't wait to have you back on for that one. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.